environmental regulators and advocates have won a landmark case in front of the Supreme Court of the United States regarding property rights. The Murr family sued St. Croix County in Wisconsin in 2013 when regulators refused to issue building permits for two homes along the wild and scenic St. Croix River, which runs through state and national parks. The property was originally purchased in 1963 as two tiny lots, but only one dwelling was ever built, and the county said it was now one small lot. Zoning regulations, now designed to protect river ecology, prohibited a second home on a single lot, a rule the family said amounted to the taking of some of the value of their property, and thus a violation of property rights. But the Supreme Court said no. And joining us to discuss the decision is Professor Richard Lazarus of Harvard Law School, who was on the winning side as a lawyer for St. Croix County. Welcome to Living on Earth, Professor.
Delighted to be here.
First, just explain to us why environmental activists are so concerned about this issue and why they were so happy about the ruling in this case.
Well, the regulatory takings issue is very important to environmental activists because it's been often used in litigation to challenge environmental restrictions on land use. It's a way to put a brake on these very important environmental restrictions, which we've enjoyed in our country now for several decades.
And just inform us, Professor, what is the takings clause of the United States Constitution? How does it get used in cases like this?
The Fifth Amendment of the Constitution provides that no private property should be taken for public use without just compensation. Most people have thought for centuries that that provision only applied for when the government actually physically took your property. But in 1922, in a decision written by no less than Oliver Wendell Holmes, with Louis Brandeis dissenting, the court announced a new constitutional doctrine. And that was one which said that if the government regulates your property to such an extent that there's no value left of it, that that amounts to a regulatory taking of your property, for which the government has to provide just compensation. It's actually a doctrine which lay dormant for decades until after the modern environmental law movement of 1970s. When the modern law, environmental law movement of the 70s passed laws like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act, it started to impose restrictions on private individuals' use of their land because it basically their private use would cause water pollution, air pollution, destroy the habitat of species.
So cases have been brought by folks opposed to those regulations saying that they lose partial value of the land and the government needs to pay them for that. So if there's a spotted owl on their territory, they can't cut down the tree, that they should get paid. They do lose value. I mean, how good is this argument?
What the court said in 1922 was when the regulation goes too far, when the economic impact is unduly burdensome, that's what will be a taking. So it's a question of degree. The environmental restrictions almost never say you can't do anything with any part of your land. What they say is you can't do something with your most environmentally fragile, sensitive part of your land. So the question is, how do you measure to what extent the economic impact is? Do you look to the whole parcel, all that they own, or do you just focus on the part of the land which is most restricted by the environmental protection regulation? And that is a big deal when it comes to whether or not people will win or lose these takings cases.
I gather in the case that you just won in front of the Supreme Court, this was a key issue, whether you look at the whole parcel or you look at the piece that you lost. Of course, if I'm the cranky landowner who can't put up a beach house because in the wetlands, I'm feeling like I lost all the value of that lot. I was banking on that.
Absolutely. And that's why you have a lot of very disappointed people in this area. I think the environmentalists respond and say, well, but you don't have a right to build in a wetland. You don't have a right to build in a floodplain. You don't have a right to destroy something which will have significant adverse impacts on other people and on future generations. And that's where the balance comes in. We have to look on the one hand on the degree to which they've been disappointed and whether their expectations that they could build were reasonable or not.
Talk to me about briefly about the details of this case that you won and what each side was claiming.
Basically, in this case, we had a family, so a series of children called the Murr family. Their parents had given them in the 1990s, they'd given them two parcels of land right next to each other along a beautiful river, the St. Croix River. And the parents had built a small studio, sort of a summer recreational cabin on one of the two parcels. And the Murr children had inherited that from their parents. And they what they wanted to do was build a house on each parcel. If two different families had owned those two different lots, they could have built a house on each lot, even though it would have caused some environmental harm, because the government, in its grace, basically says that's too harsh an impact to not let you build anything at all. But in this case, the Murrs own both lots. And what government says in St. Croix County and in counties across the United States for more than 60 years, that if you own two adjoining lots, you're not suffering such a great economic impact because you can still build the house on one lot. And we're going to effectively merge your two lots together. The MERS said, that's not fair. We should be able to build a house on each. The government said, no, this is perfectly fair. You've had your property diminished in value, but you've not been wiped out. If you haven't been wiped out, it's not a taking. This is part of the benefits and burdens of living in a civilized society and in having these kinds of ground restrictions.
There's a broad conception, Professor, that environmental land use laws reduce property values. When is this true and when is that not true? And what does this case say particularly about that?
Environmental protection restrictions are often accused of only eliminating economic value. Because in the past, the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, and certainly the private property plaintiffs in these cases, have only focused on the extent to which environmental restrictions decrease value. So somebody, for instance, owns property, and they would say, if I could build whatever I want on this property, the property would be worth $1 million. But you're only letting me build something much less intensive, and it's only worth $700,000. Therefore, you've destroyed $300,000 of my value. What the Supreme Court says here in this case is that's not a fair measure of the economic impact of environmental protection restriction. You also have to look to see what would the value of the property be if those restrictions didn't apply to anybody, not just you, but anybody. If that's the case, it might well be the property is only worth $100,000. So actually, environmental protection restrictions have decreased the full value you could get, but they've also increased the value you have. In this case, you have these two pieces of property. They were long and they were very narrow. And they basically were floodplain on the bottom, right next to each other. They then led to a steep slope. You couldn't walk across it. You couldn't traverse it at all. And the top part had a little bit of buildable land. The reason why these little slips of land, mostly floodplain and mostly steep slope, were worth about $400,000 an acre was because it was right next to the St. Croix River, a wild and scenic river, an absolutely gorgeous river, right at the bend of the river. And the government had, for the past 60 years, protected these fragile ecosystems. Yes, it'd be worth a little bit more if you could build two houses, but they had property worth $700,000 of the two lots together. That is why, in my view of this case, is this was actually not a regulatory takings case. This was a regulatory givings case. And the facts of this case showed how real economic value can be created by sound environmental protection management. And I think the court got that.
Talk to me about which justices supported the rulings, who dissented, and why.
We basically won the case 5-3. Justice Gorsuch didn't participate because he wasn't yet on the court. Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion for the court. It was joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. The Chief Justice wrote the dissent in the case, joined by Justices Thomas and Justice Alito. What's interesting about the dissent by the Chief Justice is he actually acknowledges that under his test, the county would probably win on remand. So even to that extent, it's not clear that any of the eight justices thought the county should lose in this case. He just had a different legal theory.
So how tightly closed is the door against this kind of litigation if the Chief Justice didn't go along with the majority here?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court decides things by majority vote, so it's a 5-3. The Chief Justice's dissent has some force to it, but it's just that. It's a dissent. Justice Kennedy writes a majority opinion. It's a really sweeping ruling. The more interesting question, and some would say the more sobering question going forward, is given it was that close, and there have been rumors of Justice Kennedy leaving the court, it sort of reinforced the notion there's a lot at stake if Justice Kennedy leaves the court, and there's a lot at stake if a new justice is appointed to replace Kennedy. Justice Kennedy has been on the court since the late 1980s. He has been in the majority in every single environmental case since he's joined the court, except one. He tends to be the bellwether for the Supreme Court on federal constitutional law. He's done that for decades. He did it again in the Murr case.
So when the court agreed to take this case up, Justice Scalia was still there. How did his departure, his loss, affect this decision, do you think?
I think there's every reason to think the case probably would have been decided exactly the same. But what I can say is the dynamic before the court was very different absent Justice Scalia. My first argument before the United States Supreme Court was in October 1986. It was literally just a few weeks after Justice Scalia joined the court. This is the first time I've argued a case where Justice Scalia wasn't on the bench, and it was a very different court, and it felt different. When I argued cases when Justice Scalia was there, especially a case where I was representing an environmental regulator, like a regulatory takings case, Justice Scalia was all over me for the first second. If I ever was making and scoring good points, he interrupted me and tried to derail me. If he had been on this bench, it would have been a very different argument. At oral argument, no one was challenging me the way Justice Scalia used to challenge me. No one was bringing up every possible weak point we had in the case. the way Justice Scalia would have done so. This time, I could make my argument. I could make it full. The court could hear me. And it was a very different experience.
So we're seeing increasingly the effects of global warming, and it's going to continue to increase. How will this area of the law affect government response to the challenges of climate change?
It's really in two ways. One way, we're going to need more laws to deal with actually to mitigate emissions, reduce emissions. And a lot of those laws to reduce emissions will impose restrictions on people who want to use their land in ways that cause air pollution and water pollution. The other way, though, is that we're going to need climate laws to deal with adaptation. The fact is climate change is going to happen because we've not been able to reduce our emissions over the past several decades. That is going to require more land use regulation along the coastlines, in floodplains and wetlands, to try to deal with the adverse effects of having private property development in these increasingly fragile systems along our coastal zones because of climate change. To the extent that we now have a test, a regulatory takings test, which is more sensitive to the need of government to regulate along the coastal zones, that's going to help the government deal with adaptation issues presented by climate change.
End of the day, this ruling strengthens the position of environmental regulation as compared to before this ruling came along?
I think it certainly does strengthen it, and that's because in 2003, in a decision called Palo Zolo v. Rhode Island, Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, suggested some uncertainty about how you should define the parcel. And he suggested maybe we had to move to a test so we define the parcel more narrowly. When Kennedy announced that, all environmental regulators sort of took a gasp, because if Justice Kennedy was interested in a test defining parcel which was more favorable to private land owners and private property rights advocates, that would be a significant problem for environmental regulation. We've been waiting for basically, 14 years to find out the answer to that question. We now have the answer, and that is, no, they're not going to make that step. And they not only didn't make the step, they actually announced in very broad and sweeping terms a new test, which is very favorable to government regulation.
Richard Lazarus is the Howard and Catherine Abel Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you very much.